Welcome to the Nursing and Midwifery Emporium podcast, a podcast about this nursing life. I'm Nicole Nash-Arnold from Nurse Manager HQ.
And I'm Sue Walker from the Nursing CPD Institute. And together each week, we seek out interesting people to discover what a red-hot nursing life looks like.
Hello, Wendy.
Good afternoon, Sue.
Now, today I welcome to this Nursing Life microphone Dr. Wendy McIntosh. Wendy is the creator and director of DeVar Consultancy, and DeVar Consultancy develops and delivers trainings that provide information and strategies on maintaining psychological well-being in the workplace. Now, after her fabulous podcast on professional boundaries, Nick and I now refer to Wendy as Wendy Woodpecker. That's going to be her alter ego that sits on the shoulder of the nurse, asking the four questions that Wendy has coined that determines boundary transgression. Now, Wendy is a registered nurse with over 30 years in the healthcare profession, looking in the areas of clinical education and research. 25 of those years were in mental health. Now, Wendy, welcome to this supervision microphone.
Well, thank you very much, Sue. It's a delight to be here.
Now, Wendy, for those who don't know, tell me how your business, DeVar Consultancy, got started.
So I think we've been going since about 2005, and in one of those creative moments, what do I do with my life? I saw a gap in the provision of education for professional boundaries. So I thought I would give it a go. Started off part-time. I think I was finishing my PhD at the time as well as working. So, I mean, what else do you do, Sue? You start your own business. Yeah. And so that's really how I got into it. I saw a gap and thought, I'll give this a go. And I've really enjoyed it in all the years I've been doing it, Sue. It's just been an absolute blast. Yeah.
And you have an exceptional knowledge base in the topic. So anyone listening today who hasn't listened to Wendy's podcast on professional boundaries, do yourself a favour, because it is a great presentation. However, today, Wendy, we're talking about professional supervision. Can you tell me what professional supervision is?
Yeah, I can tell you from, I guess, my perspective a little bit from the literature. And Sue, I also asked some folks that I provide supervision to also provide their ideas, because I thought that would be useful and it might be of assistance to listeners as well. But generally what we see in the literature, especially for nurses and supervision, is that it increases their self-assurance and self-belief, validates their practice, encourages them to take more responsibility, I guess, for the practice. Supervision allows people a place to check things out, especially if they're working in a culture that maybe they find challenging to the practice. So it's good for them to seek someone else out who's external to go, this is what I'm seeing, this is what I'm experiencing. Have I got it wrong, or is there something here that I can afford the money with? I think in different ways, professional supervision can assist nurses in their ability to support the patient, again, in the validation of their ideas, but also in the provision maybe of lots of different ideas, frameworks that they can consider their patient care from. And if there's particular communication difficulties or what we call kind of unconscious dynamics at play, and nurses are really challenged by or kind of wrestling with their interactions with a patient, then supervision might allow them a venue where they can explore what is going on here that's beyond just me providing care to the patient. Is there some kind of other unconscious dynamics going on in the relationship that's worth exploring? And sorry, so I think if I was just to kind of round it up, I would say that supervision allows a place to consider the patient beyond the clinical and beyond the diagnosis.
So with supervision then, is it a one-on-one interaction with the supervisor, or is it a group discussion? What does it look like for the nurse?
It looks like both of those for different people. So there are some folks that I've been seeing over a number of years now, and they choose to have individual supervision with me. And generally that is once a month. I tend to think if the sessions go beyond a month, there's something kind of lost in the relationship or the dialogue. And certainly clinicians who have one-to-one with me, when they've missed a few months, say, oh goodness, there's been that much that I wanted to talk about and wanted to explore with you, and now that moment's passed. So I think once a month is good. Sometimes, because of what's going on in the workplace, people might contact me and say, look, can we fit an extra session in? And if possible, we do that. But I also do group supervision. Again, it's usually once a month, usually with a team, or it could be with a larger group of people. Generally, what I find is if I'm providing supervision to the one team, then that's much more cohesive and I think much more beneficial for the team members. If it's supervision for a group of people that are coming in from kind of varied background, you know, they might be employed by the same organization, but they're coming in from different scopes of practice, then sometimes that doesn't work so well.
So if I'm the nurse and I'm sitting with you, is it giving me the opportunity just to reflect on what I'm doing, like what's happening within my professional life, that I just want to get a different handle on? Like, is it something that's concerning me, or is it purely a discussion of how I'm feeling professionally?
I invite people to come to the sessions with a purpose, because I think that is much more purposeful.
Mm-hmm.
However, sometimes what happens is that people come and then they sit down and they'll say, oh, look, I've been thinking about what to bring to the session. I don't have anything clear that I want to discuss. And I'll say something like, oh, well, let's just get going and see what happens. And usually in the let's get going and see what happens, there's a huge amount of stuff kind of bubbling beneath. And the beauty of good supervision, I think, is that if you say less and allow the supervisee to say more, as they start to talk and kind of unburden themselves of things that they didn't even realise was burdening them, they start to see the links themselves. So they go, oh, crikey, here I am reflecting and talking, and I can actually see what the issue is. Oh, goodness, I can see what part I played in that. So sometimes the process of just talking, maybe debriefing, and just going for it is enough for people to go, aha, and now I can see what was going on, and thank you very much for just being there. But for other times, maybe there's real complexities within the client's presentation or complexities within that professional relationship. And that's where it's good to go deeper into things like the idea of transference, or the idea of transactional analysis, to try and explore at a much deeper level what is actually going in, what I call intrapsychically within the clinician, that is maybe being disturbed. I don't mean that negatively. I just mean there's a disturbance within them that somehow is getting in the way of their thinking or their feeling when they go to work with that patient.
So the supervision experience enhances the patient experience as well?
I think it can do. It's maybe not easy to see a clear relationship, but I absolutely believe, and clinicians tell me this, that when they are not in conflict about issues that are there for them, then they can approach the patients much clearer and with a much better idea about the care that they want to provide. And so that has to enhance patient care when a clinician is much more purposeful about the relationship that they have with the client and their approach towards that client. Yeah. But trying to get research that shows an absolute clear relationship, I'm not sure that that exists. So it'd be much more of the anecdotal, I think, and the experiential.
So Wendy, what do? You need specific skills and or training to become a professional supervisor in this context that we're talking about?
There are qualifications that people can get to become supervisors, and you can get that through universities or specifically accredited areas that specialise in supervision. I think it's helpful to have a few years of experience behind you and, if possible, varied experience, because as a supervisor, I think the broader range of tools that you can choose from, the broader range of theories that you kind of refer to, really assists the clinician. And I say clinician, but I also offer supervision to people who are not clinicians. So sometimes, depending on what people bring forward, the conversation might be clinical, or it might go political, it might go funding, it might go systemic to what's happening in the system, it might go to an ethical concern. So I think I don't have a background in the humanities, but I've done a lot of work around that area and psychodrama, as you know, that I love. Psychodrama really embraces the humanities. I think a supervisor that's able to draw in a broad spectrum of ideas can be in a better position to assist clinicians in the work that they do or the concerns that they have. It's good that the supervisor, I think, it's good that the supervisor is getting their own supervision so that they can check in with their supervisor that the work they're doing with people is meeting ethical requirements, is meeting kind of boundary requirements. So just like supervisees would come to me with issues, if I'm doing work with a supervisee and then I reflect afterwards and I go, I'm not sure that that was the right thing I said or did there. I wonder if there's another intervention. I'll take that to my supervisor and then we'll just explore that. And I can go, thank you. I can take that back to the next session and kind of integrate that into the work that I do. So I would certainly advocate that supervisors have their own supervision as well.
So, Wendy, is there ever a time where professional supervision could be detrimental? Like here I'm thinking about an unskilled supervisor or a situation where management just sweeps under the carpet an issue where bad outcomes have occurred.
I think both of those are very true. And sometimes you can have the most skilled supervisor, but for whatever reason, the relationship with the supervisee just doesn't work, or the content within a group supervision doesn't go in the right direction. So yes, supervision can be detrimental because the relationship doesn't work or the supervisor isn't skilled or trained enough in what's been brought forward. I think it's always good to check in with organisations. What's your purpose in having your staff go to supervision? Do you just want to tick a box to meet an accreditation standard? Or do you want them to be thoughtful? Do you want them to challenge? Do you want them to bring concerns to you? Because that's a lot of the work that happens in supervision. People might bring forward concerns that they have about an organisation or a systemic process that they're experiencing. And so some of the work will be, so let's look at that through your code of ethics or your code of conduct. So it might mean that the supervisee individually or as a group takes that back to management. And as you say, management doesn't want to know or sweep it under the carpet. And I think that's then where supervision can get maybe a bit more awkward, because part of supervision is to make the client, or not to make anything, but to facilitate a robustness and what I call a professional authority within the clinician to challenge and to bring forward solutions, but to challenge unethical, unprofessional conduct that's going on in workplaces. So it does carry a risk.
Is the process confidential?
Absolutely, it should be, and absolutely it is for me. So I usually say to both individuals and groups, especially the group, I require you to be confidential. This is part of your professional, you know, code of ethics. However, if something emerges individually or in the group where there is really an ethical concern and someone's life's at risk for whatever reason, then I won't break confidentiality, but I want you to take this to the responsible places where it needs to go. And I'll be good to have feedback from you about what happened when you did that. And certainly with folks I've worked with up till now, that's happened. And, you know, changes have been made in practice or changes have been made in patient care. So fabulous for those nurses and practitioners that have been willing to challenge.
And Wendy, if something detrimental happens in the workplace, so a colleague takes their own life, is that an area where supervision can assist the group if they've bonded as a group? Or is that a totally different kettle of fish where you're looking at critical incident debriefing?
Yeah, look, Sue, I see critical debriefing as different to supervision. One area where it's different is a person that's called in to be critical debrief may have no prior relationship with the individual or the team. So that kind of changes the dynamic. Usually there is a specific purpose to a critical debrief that requires not different skills, but there's just a different purpose. And usually, of course, it'll only go for a limited period of time. It might just go for 2 to 4 sessions, whereas professional supervision could go on for years. Like, so for 2 of the groups that I see, I've been seeing them for about 10 years now. You build up quite a relationship as a supervisee and a supervisor in that situation, which generally is a good thing. Of course, sometimes, you know, old relationships start to rub, and sometimes there comes a time where it's, and now we have to say goodbye. So yes, a supervisor can also do critical debriefing, especially if we've got specific training in that area, of course.
Yeah,
it's a good thing. But there are changes. If I was going into a critical debrief situation and I was wearing my professional supervision hat, I would just miss the beat a little bit. So I have to go and go, and this is a critical debrief, the specific purpose here. It's just a different warm-up, yeah.
Well, what a fabulous opportunity to form a relationship with a group of professionals and work through so many situations with them if you've been with them for 10 years. That's an amazing relationship.
Yeah, and look, I take my hats off to them because they're pretty courageous to keep travelling with me for 10 years. But part of what they appreciate, I think, is that being challenged and to be validated. I think that's really important, especially in systems that can be very challenging, that can create moral distress, that can have people wondering, have they got it really wrong? What's going on here? So I've really appreciated the journey that I've been on with folks, and that they have trusted me and trusted the process enough to keep traveling with me.
Now, Wendy, can you see a time when professional supervision becomes mainstream within the nursing profession?
Hesitancy in my response.
And why is that hesitancy there?
Yeah, I think it's because I have a wish in me that it does become mainstream throughout nursing. As I say, not that nurses have to, you know, you must go to supervision, but that it's on offer and the freedom for staff to choose to go. As I think we've talked about previously, it started in the world of mental health. It's moved into the area of midwifery and palliative care, and some of the specialised units where the small team kind of invite professional supervision in. Organisations have some reservations, not just because of the challenges might come out with from supervision, but also because the evidence on how effective it is, or the research on how effective it is, very difficult to prove it in terms of monetary gain. You know, there's the expense of paying a supervisor for an hour, and then there's the expense of paying the staff members to go to supervision for an hour. That's been an age-old argument. I think if we erred on the side of when you have clinicians who are critical, analytical thinkers, clinicians who kind of look at a patient and problem solve multiple layer of consideration, then the patient and the team outcome has to be better, and thus the outcome for the hospital has to be better. But again, because there's not enough evidence to show that relationship between clinical supervision, better patient outcome, better outcome for the hospital, it's a debate that I think has to be ongoing, and it needs champions out there and to encourage or advocate for it for their staff. So if you've got senior clinicians or managers or educators out there who for whatever reason have never had clinical supervision, or they've had it and had a really bad experience, then there's no buy-in for them to bring someone into their unit and to encourage their staff to go. So my wish is yes, because I do believe, I know how valuable it's been for me. It's probably allowed me to stay connected to a profession I love for years at a point where I was at, where it was, I think it's time to leave.
Yeah.
Know that for many people that I've worked with, supervision, not necessarily for me, but supervision has allowed them to stay connected to the profession because they've understood what the conflicts, the disturbance, the disquiet is within them. And they find a place to reflect on that and identify strategies for them rather than just going to work every day and feeling like they're knocking their head or feeling like they're not appreciated or feeling like all those things that you and I know our colleagues experience out there, which is not so good for their health. Supervision allows them that place for them once a month. It's not a big ask, but for organisations, maybe it's still too huge.
Wendy, thanks for being our guest at the Nursing and Midwifery Emporium podcast today and sharing with us your nursing journey and your thoughts about professional supervision, as well as all the wonderful work you do with DeVar Consultancy.
Pleasure. Thank you. Thank you, Sue.
It's always lovely to talk.
Yes. Is there time for me to share someone who gave me some feedback to use for today?
I thought you were going to ask, is there time for me to sing a quick song? But I would have said yes. I would say yes to either. Please share it. Yeah.
Because I think, you know, this maybe summarizes what I've been saying. I value that the clinical supervision that I receive validates my practice. It encourages me to stop and think outside of the box and to continually learn. We often become so busy and sometimes complacent so that we just don't make time for our own well-being and professional development. For me, I know it widens my thinking, my nursing knowledge. It also helps me deal with the stressors of the job. I believe that this makes me a better nurse in the end.
Well, I think that is a fabulous testimonial to the worth of professional supervision.
Yeah, I think so too, Sue.
Yeah, lovely. Wendy, thank you again for being our guest.
My pleasure. And I look forward to the next time, if there is a next time round the corner.
Excellent. Be good.
Okay, Sue. Bye now.
Bye.
Sue, how are you?
Nicole, I'm exceptionally well today.
I love Wendy Woodpecker. I think she is fabulous.
You got to love a Wendy Woodpecker.
I know. She is so clever and her experience is amazing and everything that she has to say about her world is so captivating in terms of and compelling. That's the way that she operates and what she does and how important that is to deal with everything that we deal with. Nursing's not an easy gig. Nursing and midwifery is not an easy gig, no matter what clinical niche you're in. And this is such an obvious thing to be able to deal with that adversity.
And it seems it is so obvious that I get confused as to why we just aren't doing it.
I thought your question at the end there was absolutely inspired when you asked her the question about, Wendy, can you see a time when clinical supervision is mainstream in nursing and midwifery? And she struggled to answer that. And I loved her answer because for her, she can see the power that it has in doing so many things, like, you know, that it allows people to deal with unconscious dynamics and the way in which they communicate. They get to explore evidence-based innovations before we go further. It offers people a community of practice to explore really challenging issues, that there's take more responsibility, validate your ideas and your practice. And it doesn't have to be a mental health context for that to be really powerful.
No, it doesn't have to be a mental health context, because the same issues of involvement and relationship and, you know, wanting best outcome and exploring the best way to get that is relevant to all spheres of nursing.
Mm. If you're working in a critical care unit or in an ICU unit or in the perioperative unit or in pediatrics, then that moral distress that she talks about is present no matter what clinical niche you're in.
I agree.
I was telling you before about how I read this article about managing burnout in nurses, which now, of course, the World Health Organization has made that burnout, workplace burnout, a diagnosable condition. So we're finally at a time in the world where everyone's caught up to say this is a real thing. And this article explored workplace adversity and sort of put it in a context like, if you're in a workplace and you're exposed to radiation, then you manage your exposure to radiation by wearing lead gowns and removing yourself if you're not needed in the room and a whole load of different things. And yet we're exposed to workplace adversity all of the time. That might be staffing, it might be union issues, it might be just the pure patriarchy of nursing, our safety, workload issues, of course. Tragedy and mortality is present in pretty much every clinical role that we undertake. And that all ends up being one big bag of moral distress. And yet we don't do anything to manage our exposure to that moral distress.
No, because it's seen as a weakness. It's seen as, like, you know, you've chosen the job, you've taken on the job, you've got to learn to manage, you know, how you work within the job. But psych nurses, and as you rightfully say, Nick, psychologists and those people within mental health have realized the benefit of supervision and in a lot of cases pay for their own supervision.
Mm.
And they see it.
I wonder why I haven't.
But they see it purely as a way for them to be able to be a better healthcare professional and a way for them to be a better person outside of that role as well.
Mm.
But it's interesting. Translated to the broader context of healthcare delivery.
No, exactly. And it was interesting, even recently, what we're learning and what we're bearing witness to with our nursing and midwifery colleagues being exposed to a significant amount of workplace adversity thanks to COVID-19. Particularly in those places like US, UK and Spain.
Yeah, bless
you. And so you see these comments on Facebook from other people saying, well, you signed up for this. And of course, we didn't sign up for this. No one signed up for this. You know, that tends to be a bit of a underlying assumption when nurses and midwives are dealing with moral distress and workplace adversity. Well, you signed up for that.
Yeah, that's right. But we didn't sign up to be used and abused, and we didn't sign up to be having to have our own sewing circles to bloody create protective equipment.
No.
We didn't sign up to have to work our own way through a patriarchal healthcare system where we unfortunately happen to be the largest group. And because we are the largest group, the bean counters automatically just think dollars.
Mm. You know?
Like, if we were a group of psychiatrists where there might be two in a health centre,
yep,
they'll send you off to Hayman Island for a week so that you can debrief and have a CPD session.
Mm.
If there's 350 of you, they're not going to give you the same courtesy.
Yep.
And it's purely based on numbers, not necessarily what is right or wrong. It's purely based on our numbers as to what they think that they can afford.
And even if that were the case and that, you know, there were some things that are inaccessible, which they are, but there is 400,000 of us. You can argue whether we signed up for it or not, but even if we signed up for it and then we got there, there still needs to be an avenue for us to be able to manage our exposure to that and that emotional labour that we carry requires us not just to suck it up and get on with it. This is not a stiff upper lip, carry on, you know, sort of thing. This is a, well, now I'm here. I'm distressed. What do I do about it?
And I have the right to remain healthy mentally, yes, psychologically, and physically.
Yeah.
Can I just say, whoever those people were who were replying back on Facebook, you signed up for this.
Mm.
Aren't those people lucky that people do sign up for it?
I know.
And I think we should track them down. And when they're in hospital, we'll smile sweetly and go, aren't you lucky we signed up for this thing?
Oh, it's extraordinary. So angry, Nick. I know. It's really frustrating. But there are people that really think that. But, you know, we are in a place where we do have those things going on. And we have to manage our exposure. Now, most organisations offer EAP, but sometimes it's not a psychological injury that we're dealing with. It's not psychology that we're looking for. It's not that we need to be fixed. It's the fact that the thing that clinical supervision is quite different to that. You know, validating practice, taking more responsibility for your practice, contributing to that community, exploring challenging issues, explore what evidence-based innovations look like with someone like that, taking, you know, clinical risks. That's not the work of a psychologist. That's work of a Wendy McIntosh. And so it's a very different thing that we need to be able to manage our exposure to moral distress and workplace adversity.
Yes, yes. It's supervision is not about fixing people who are broken.
No.
It's about preventing people from becoming broken.
Exactly.
And Wendy does it exceptionally well.
Mm.
And anyone who's listening, if you want to explore supervision, there's a link in where the podcast is housed. Go and have a look at Wendy's website. Have a talk to Wendy. As you can hear, she loves to have a chat.
Yes,
she does. She loves to chat. She's very passionate about her work.
Mm. And that's where Wendy sits on this spectrum. You know, at one end we've got burnout and one end we've got thriving. And burnout is when we need the psychologist, but to survive and thrive is when we need Wendy.
That's it. We need to prevent getting to that other end of that continuum.
Mm.
We want people to be professionally happy and personally joyful.
Mm.
That's where we need to be. We don't, you know, your workplace, and it's a workplace health and safety issue. Your workplace should not contribute to your ill health.
Mm.
And it's fundamentally, see, we should take that path.
Well, we should be saying to employee assistance programs are amazing, but there should be a menu of things where I'm not yet psychologically injured with burnout, but I can see how I might get there and I would like to survive and thrive by using someone like Wendy with clinical supervision. And that should be on the menu of EAP options.
Look, what a fabulous idea, sister.
God, we solved some problems on this podcast,
Look, I love a good problem solve. Love it. And it's been nice talking with you, Nick.
See you next time.
Okay, see you, mate. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Nursing and Midwifery Emporium. Make sure you visit us at the website www.nmemporium.com to subscribe to the podcast.
And if you'd like to put someone forward for us to interview, go to the same website and just click on the button.
See you guys.
Take care. Bye.